IR Simplified Podcast, episode 77. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me here on this another episode of the IR Simplified Podcast. I've got a couple of things to get through on this episode. I'm going to be talking about and sharing my additional thoughts on a LinkedIn update I posted earlier on last week about bullying in the workplace. I'll be having a little bit of a rant and sharing my comments on an article that appeared in the newspaper about two employees being terminated for sleeping in the workplace. I will also be talking about, sharing some tips for those who are novices to conducting workplace investigations and answering one of the questions that I've been asked or do get asked a lot about first aiders in the workplace. So without further ado, let's get on with the show. Now, first cab off the rank today is talking about a LinkedIn post that I posted. When was it? Last week now, talking about our attitudes with regards to workplace bullying and sexual harassment. Now, I've asked the question, have we got it all wrong? Now, to clarify, I'm not doing this to say that I disagree with what is being done, that we should be, that we shouldn't be paying attention to it. What I'm doing is asking this so we continue to have a discussion and find out the best ways of managing this, because this is the thing, we're all human. We've all got our own particular views and thoughts on different things. So, as much as people want you to believe it, I don't think that we're ever going to get to a position where we can totally eradicate sexual harassment out of the workplace. Now, this is the thing. To clarify again, and as something else as well, is that I'm only talking about the things that are said and the comments that are made and all that sort of stuff. I'm not talking about any physical contact, because physical contact, regardless of whether it's in a quote-unquote workplace bullying situation or a sexual harassment situation, there are specific laws targeting that, and they need to be dealt with under those laws. They don't need to be classed as, brought under the whole workplace bullying and sexual harassment banner. So, that being said, if we have a look at the stats from the recently released Australian Human Rights Commission report, it says that 19% of respondents have experienced sexually suggestive comments or jokes, and 14% had intrusive questions about their private life or physical appearance. Now, and it's the thing, so my thoughts are, what if we taught people to become more resilient to these things and to not be as upset or as insulted when these questions or comments are made? And this is the thing, is that there was a percentage of people that have claimed that being looked at in a particular way is sexual harassment. Now, whether that is or isn't, that is entirely up to you to make the assessment yourself. But this is the thing. People will always do inappropriate things. And as I said, that's basically because we are human. Whether, I've got a four-year-old who I swear is becoming an adult every day. And every once in a while we'll be out shopping or doing something and he will say something that, isn't appropriate, whether he's, drops an F-bomb or something like that. Yes, because he's heard me say it and because he's heard other people say it. And it's the thing. So all we can do is say, hey, you know what, that's not appropriate, that's not a nice thing to say in this environment, or that's not something that we do when we're out in public or whatever it is. So maybe if we became a bit more resilient and taught people, to not respond to things that other people say. Now, at the bottom of that article, I didn't close a link to a Brooks Gibbs YouTube thing where he did a short speech somewhere in one of the universities in the United States, and he's talking about that we're creating a generation of emotional marshmallows. And I agree with what he's saying, because we're not treating people to become resilient to it. We're teaching people and encouraging people that if they don't like what is being said, that they can make a complaint about it. You have a look at, I have mentioned about it before as well, is that with the views that people have and how overly sensitive and maybe overreacting to claims of bullying that various HR departments and managers have, is that if someone's having a, you know, a tough conversation with them, a performance management conversation with someone, or anything like that, where this person doesn't feel that the, you know, the manager or the supervisor who was talking to them isn't literally blowing wind up their Khyber and praising everything that they're doing, then hey, bang, I'll go and make a, you know, workplace bullying complaint about it. And, you know, it's the thing is that maybe, you know, we need to be teaching people to become more resilient to it rather than, hey, someone said something not nice to me, so I'm going to run and tell the teacher or I'm going to run and tell someone else. Now, I will admit that a lot of this is heavily influenced by the, you know, the reading and the learning that I'm doing on Stoicism that I've been doing for probably the last 12 months now. Sort of the depth of what I go into it is increasing a bit more. So, and, you know, and one of the things that they talk about that is that the only thing that you can really control is the way that you respond to things. Now, you know, there are a couple of life coaches and all that sort of stuff around that do say that, is that the only thing that you can control is how you respond to it. So if you're getting upset by something that someone said, what is it about what was said that actually caused you to react that way? And all that sort of stuff. Now, a lot of people may know that I'm vegan, so, you know, you can't have any discussions with anyone without that, you know, without saying, you know, that you're vegan or talking about veganism. When people will talk about lack of protein, people will say bacon, people will say all sorts of things like that, that, you know, after a while, are they doing it for inquisitive reasons? Are they doing it to mock you? Are they doing it to pick on you? Are they doing it because they don't know any different? And it's the thing, I could choose to get upset about that. Most of the time I don't. It's just like, yep, all right, that's just something that someone else does. That's what I know people will do as soon as I say, hey, I'm vegan, and all that sort of stuff. So, but this is the thing, you know, with situations like that, we need to become more resilient. With situations in the workplace, we need to become more resilient, because it's the thing, if someone puts a complaint in about how someone was talking, and then without knowing what that person meant by what they were saying or why they were saying it or anything like that, then, you know, it just creates all sorts of problems that may not be needed in the workplace. So, you know, it's the thing. As I said, everyone will say something inappropriate at one point or another. And it's the thing is that how people respond to that is what should be the focus, not what someone has said. Because this is the thing, is that we're creating an environment where what people say has more of an impact and carries more weight than the way people react to things. Now, it's the thing. You know, you can talk about anything and someone will be upset about it somewhere. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about what's happening overseas with the president. Sorry, I just think that everything that's going on about that is rather amusing. But, you know, all the people that are saying this and that about, you know, an overseas president, saying things about our prime minister, saying things about, you know, anything, there will always be something that someone will get upset about. So it's the thing, we need to be teaching people and how to not be upset by things, and also creating environments and cultures in workplaces where that if someone comes in and does say something that upsets someone, that A, the person that was, you know, that had something said to them that was upset has the courage and the confidence and the support to be able to turn around and say, hey, you know what, that's not appropriate, that's not how we do things here, as well as having the culture to teach that person and to encourage that person not to behave that way. If they continue to behave that way, well then, yeah, maybe they're not a right fit for that environment, so then maybe things should be done about their employment. But, you know, it's the thing is that, you know, I'm still firmly of the view that, yes, we are doing things wrong. The more we pay attention to something, the more it's going to happen. And instead, we should be looking at ways to, you know, to minimise the outcome of it, to minimise the stress involved in it and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, I'm not going to rant too much more about this one. Otherwise, it'll be an hour-long podcast. It'll be one of those discussions that, you know, there are so many more things that we could be doing that I don't believe that we are doing, that we need to be doing to improve the workforce. So anyway, next thing that I'm going to be talking about is probably another one that I'm going to get on my soapbox about, and that is the two employees that were terminated from their employment for sleeping during a break. Now, in case you missed it, there was an article that appeared in the Canberra Times on the 22nd, whatever day that was. It says two permanent workers fell asleep in the day surgery area. This was about 4 a.m. in the morning while all theatres were closed. It says, about 4 a.m. during their designated unpaid break. Now, the contractor ISS labelled this as a serious breach of the company's code of conduct and terminated their employment. Now, this has appeared in the paper because I would believe that conciliation and some sort of way to find a mutual resolution to it has any attempts has broken down between the union and the employer. So it's sort of appeared in the paper because it hasn't gone to the commission yet, or it's working its way through the mechanisms of the commission. So, but this is the thing, 4 a.m. in a unused day surgery area, is that something that warrants termination? I don't believe so, especially during their unpaid break. Now, if it was during a shift time, then maybe, you could talk to them about it. Still, even if it was during their designated work time, I don't think, termination would be warranted. Maybe, especially because, it's the thing, they're not doing something that you would call a mission critical role, not compared to the security guard who was terminated last year or the year before and then won off a dismissal application because his termination happened some weeks after the incident, and then the employer turned around and said, it was gross misconduct and all that sort of stuff. So, but this is the thing. Falling asleep in the workplace. But, anyway, all that aside, the thing that we need to be asking ourselves and that, I would have thought that the media would have been looking at is why did two employees fall asleep in the workplace? Now, additionally, going into that further as well, is that if the employees were that fatigued that they fell asleep or decided to take their unpaid break as a time to have a sleep and get refreshed, what does that say about the duty of care with regards to any potential fatigue-related incidents that would have happened at the end of shift if they hadn't have had that time to have a nap and to refresh themselves? So, this is the thing. I think that there is so much more going on with this that obviously we're not being told, that hopefully does come out if it goes through to the commission, which now that it's been brought out in the media, I have a feeling that it will probably get resolved that way. The contractor isn't looking made to look too bad and all that sort of stuff. But it's the thing, if your employees are going to have a snooze in the workplace, having a snooze during their break, let them. And it's the thing, going back to what I was saying before is about fatigue related incidents. Now, I can't see the commission will turn around and say, yes, the act of falling asleep during your own time or during an unpaid break is not appropriate and is something that is a sackable offence. So I don't think that they will do that. That being said, if they do that, what happens then? So what happens during that, if an employee does something, they might have had a long shift, a 12-hour shift or something like that, could have been because of the weather, they couldn't have slept during the day, they're a night shift employee, they would have been able to sleep during their 45-minute lunch break, they couldn't because, you can't do that, otherwise you get sanked. What happens if they go home on their way home or doing something or even during the second part of their shift where they have a fatigue-related incident? What happens from there? Who's responsible for that one? Is it the commission's going to turn around and have the finger pointed at them because they've turned around and said, no, you can't sleep in the workplace? Is it going to be the employer because they've gone along with what the commission said and said, hey, you can't sleep in the workplace? It's just one of those humongous little minefields that honestly I can't see why, apart from maybe a few, whether there is stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't know about that has caused this matter not to be settled or conciliation or even for termination to happen in the first place. Now, maybe if they were told repeatedly that they can't be, that these employees can't be sleeping in that area, then, if they continue to do that, I think that maybe might have more to do with the culture of the organisation and the environment that they're in You know, is there anywhere that they can sleep that's not out in an unused area of the hospital or anything like that? What's their break room like? Is it sufficient that if they do want to spend half an hour having a bit of shut-eye during their own time, that they're able to do that? If they're not, well, you know, those are questions that need to be asked of the employer. So anyway, look forward to seeing how this one plays out, hopefully in the commission and not in the media. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about is a couple of points and things that I see people forgetting or not really paying that much attention to when conducting a workplace investigation. Now, this isn't necessarily meant for the novice investigator because, you know, not picking on them. I mean, you know, I've seen people that you would think would be experienced investigators because they say that they've been doing it for, you know, X or Y years, and then you have a look at what they've done and, you know, they've missed some of the most important points of conducting workplace investigations. So, and in that case, you know, they've probably been taught wrong or taught a particular way that maybe hasn't emphasized these points or even been made aware of these points, or they've just picked up bad habits along the way. So here are some of the, what did I say in the article? Seven simple things to remember about workplace investigations. And I would say that one of the most important things that you do, and it is number one, is the scope of the investigation. Now, by that I mean, you know, for want of a better term, is that how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go with regards to the claims and counterclaims and even counterclaims that are made during the process of conducting a workplace investigation, because it doesn't matter, you know, what it is that you're going to hear something. Oh yeah, you know, that happened, but then, you know, I only did that because they did this, or when I did that, it was in response to something else that they did, or, you know, so and so has been doing this to someone else and I only did that to stop them from doing it to me, and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, these things do come out, and you know, it's the thing is that, you know, you need to decide on how far down, as I said, for want of a better term, down the rabbit hole you go. The scope, you know, ideally would have some sort of plan set in place as soon as you've got the complaint, though I would be looking at refining it a bit more and deciding once you've spoken to the person who made the complaint, and then maybe revisiting it again after you've spoken to the person who the complaint has been made against. And, you know, that is, as I said, you know, you may have an allegation, oh, so-and-so is bullying me because of this, or so-and-so did something like that, whereas when you have a discussion with them, you find out that, oh, you know what, maybe the response is being complained about is actually, or the action that someone is being complained about is a response to something else that was done. So it's the thing is that, you know, you can't keep the scope too narrow to just deal with one thing, and though the other side of the coin is you can't have it too wide where you'll be covering everything that gets mentioned, because, you know, that could potentially be something that is never ending, and that's the last thing that we want when we're conducting a workplace investigation. Now, once you've got the scope out of the way, the next thing that you need to do is to plan it. So obviously, you'll have some sort of plan in place of talking. You've received the complaint. Okay, the first thing you're going to do is you've looked at the complaint, decided that, yes, a workplace investigation is warranted. You've created the scope. Okay, we're going to investigate the complaint made by Mary against Bill. Then you go and have a chat to Mary. Okay, yep. And then from there, so then you've got that plan. So you chat to Mary, then you chat to Bill. Though, like revisiting the scope after you've spoken to the person who the complaint has been made against, is that you may need to revisit the plan because, you know, there may be additional witnesses or additional bits of information that come out that will help you with that. As well as that, and also going down the path of looking at the scope, is that you may need to expand the plan of your workplace investigation. So, you know, depending on who you talk to, so there'll be plans, okay, for whatever it is, someone's made a complaint against someone else for bullying in the workplace. Okay, so you need to talk to the complainant, you need to talk to the person who it's made against, you need to talk to any corroborating witnesses, you'd also need to go and have a look at their personnel file to see when the last time they were aware or made aware of their policies regarding workplace bullying and harassment for the organisation. The last time that was, any additional training that they've done, if they were even there on the days that it was claimed that this person behaved in a particular manner. So these are all things that you need to look at. You can't just turn around and say, oh, yep, you know what, that's right. You know, we'll just go down based on what the initial complainant has said, because, you know, you do that, you may end up with a very one-sided investigation that if it does go further, you will end up in all sorts of trouble for it. The next thing I would be doing is making sure that you have adequately notified all the people who will be involved in it. So obviously you've got the complaint, so you need to notify the person who made the complaint that, you know, invite them in for a meeting and all that sort of stuff. If they don't turn up, well, that's going to change where you can go down, what you can do and all that sort of stuff. So you send out the invitation or request to attend a meeting for them. Then you need to do it for the person who the complaint is against. You'd also have to notify any people who are going to be witnesses, for the complainant or for the person who's responding to the allegation. And, you know, the notification, I would go down the formal path and doing it in writing rather than by verbal, or pick up the phone and say, oh, you know, by the way, you've got to turn up for this, because at least if it's in writing and there's some sort of paper trail that, if it does go further, then you've got, you can say, okay, yes, we did, you know, we did everything that a reasonable person would be expected to do. So, you know, and it's the thing, the magic of all this sort of stuff is that if it does go further, it's a reasonable person test. So, you know, if you want someone to attend, okay, let's say, you know, the allegation's been made against, Bill for doing whatever in the workplace. I wouldn't just send an email off to Bill and say, oh, by the way, in 20 minutes you've got to turn up at the manager's office because we're having a chat to you about this. That's not reasonable, and a reasonable person wouldn't be expected to comply with that, because 20 minutes notice of something, well, you know, is it something that happened 10 minutes ago? Is it something that happened 2 days ago? Whatever. You know what? So for me, at the minimum, I would give people 24 hours notice. That seems to be something that is accepted, though if I'm conducting one or being involved in one, taking lead on one, my rule of thumb or what I like to do is try and give at least 24 hours. Most of the time it's 48 hours notice. This is more for the fact of that, you know, not everyone can find a support person in, you know, less than 24 hours, you know, whether it's your neighbour or someone else or a friend or a colleague or something like that. Not everyone is available to do things at the drop of a hat. So, you know, ideally 48 hours notice, you give the person enough time to find a support person. You've given them enough time to collect any information that they need. And you'd also, you know, if you're inviting someone in or requiring someone to come in for a meeting to answer any allegations, you'd detail what the allegations are so they know what they're responding to. You just can't, you know, let them turn up to a meeting unannounced, or an announced meeting, but unprepared, and say, you know, hit them with all these questions, because, you know, you could end up on the wrong side of an unfair dismissal application for that one. And the next point that I've noticed that people have been forgetting or even not paying that much attention to is that the standard of proof that we have. We've only got to meet, doing workplace investigations, we've only got to meet the balance of probabilities. We don't have to prove anything beyond a reasonable doubt or anything like that. And it's the thing is that it's not up to us to prove or disprove anything. It's up to us to provide a report to say whether an allegation has been substantiated or unsubstantiated. Now, it's, you know, you may think that they're interchangeable terms. They aren't. So, you know, it's a thing. Lower standard of proof, balance of probabilities, that's the thing. So that's all we need to satisfy. We don't need to keep hounding people for questions or keep digging for answers. And this comes back into the next point that I want to raise, or that I think people do, especially novice ones, do tend to forget, and that is that we're not conducting an inquisition. All we're doing is just gathering information to present a report whether allegations have been substantiated or not. So, you know, that's the thing. You ask them questions. You don't need to berate or give them a barrage of questions and slam things on tables and you know, keep them in there, ask the same question over and over and over and over again until they break, because, you know, that may be fine and dandy to what you see on TV and for those who have responsibilities under the criminal jurisdictions. But, you know, that's not us as workplace investigators. We've got balance the probabilities, and it's not an inquisition. Ask him questions. We've got no authority to compel people to answer questions. You know, you can invite whoever you want to a workplace investigation meeting. Could be, you know, a list as long as your arm for allegations that have been raised against them. If they don't want to turn up, you can't make them turn up. If they do turn up and they just sit there and say nothing, you can't compel them to answer any questions. Now, granted, if they don't answer any questions, it has the highly likely probability that it will result in termination of employment. But it's the thing, it's, you know, it's up to them. They can sit there and say nothing. It's entirely up to them. We've got no coercive powers. We've got nothing to compel these people to, you know, someone who's been invited to attend a meeting, got nothing to compel them to answer any questions that we ask. So sort of flying on with that one is the next thing, and, you know, it's the thing, while I'm going through a couple of points, they are all equally as important. You can't skip one or not pay any attention to the other one. And this is something that, when I'm going through conducting courses and all that sort of stuff, this is one of the ones, probably the first ones that I drum into people and get them to remember, recite, and be aware of, and that is that you're dealing with another human being. So as you're dealing with another human being, how would you like to be treated the way that you're treating someone else? So, you know, this is the thing, going back to the reasonable notice, and it's not an inquisition. If you give someone, you know, 10 minutes or an hour's notice or half a day's notice or whatever, a shift notice, that they've got to turn up to something, how would you like it? If you're berating them, asking them questions over and over again, slamming things on the table and all that sort of stuff, getting probably emotional or a little bit too overpassionate about questions that you're asking, how would you feel if you the roles were reversed and someone was doing that to you? If you wouldn't like it, don't do it to someone else. It doesn't matter whether your view is or whether you believe that the person has committed, you know, a list of grievances as long as your arm. It's not up to you to do that. All you're doing there is to just gather information to present a finding. And this one, or gathering information and treating people the same way, sort of does flow into the next bit, and that is to report what you find. Now, by that, you know, you go through the process, you will discover little bits and pieces. You'll discover bits of information that, while may not be relevant to the investigation, may be outside of the scope of it, some of it should be discussed. You don't include, things that you know, a reasonable person would find trivial. And it's the thing, you know, some reasonable person, oh, you love that person, while everyone uses them a lot, there's not many people who you could say would be reasonable about this or reasonable about that. That's a completely different story. So going on this thing, report what you find. If you have discovered during the process of the investigation that, hey, maybe two colleagues are having a relationship that they haven't disclosed to management, indicate that in the report. If you think that there's instances of managers not being as proactive or as responsible as that they should in their roles, and it does come out during the process of investigation, report that, because, you know, it's the thing is that while it's in your report and it may not have some, you know, a great deal of bearing on the matter that you're investigating, it may shed a bigger picture on the culture of the organisation and things like that. So, that's the thing. So, you know, report what you discover. Don't hold anything back. Don't think, oh, you know what, maybe it's not really relevant. Trivial matters, yes. Relevant matters, it's not up to you to decide what's relevant and what's not. All you're doing is reporting on the things that have been, the information that's been discovered or disclosed during the during this investigation. And that's the thing. And the bonus point for this is that when you do compile the report or even go through the process of conducting a workplace investigation, do it in a way that is likely to withstand scrutiny by some third party. So whether it's going to the Fair Work Commission or whether it's going to a discrimination commission hearing or something like that. So you need to conduct it in a manner that would be liable to stand up for scrutiny from those parts. And, you know, and it's the thing is that if you're conducting a workplace investigation and it does result in the termination of someone's employment and it does go to the commission's not going to look too favourably upon it. If you're haphazard with it, you're doing things on whims, you haven't, you've you know, a one-page report or two-page report for that to say, oh, yeah, you know what? You know what? They're guilty. They've done this. That may not go go down too well in the commission. So this is the thing. You know, there are things, obviously, putting all this in place does take some skill, but they're important things that you need to remember when you're conducting a workplace investigation. Now, having a look at the time, going a little bit over the amount of time that I did want to have for this podcast episode. But that being said, I've still got to get through this Q&A, so I'll try and make this one as quick as possible without getting on too much of my soapbox. Now, this one is a Q&A. The question was asked about how many first aiders that they need in their office in Queensland. Now, the question is, we have a small professional services business here in Queensland of about 25 employees. How many first aiders do we need? Now, this is a bit of an interesting question, and, you know, I'll probably get into grief for answering it the way that I have, but it's the thing is that obviously we know we need at least one. That being said, why not train everyone up on being first aid qualified? You know, you've got 25 employees, not sure, you know, how, for want of a better term, slush with funds that you are to be able to do it. But, you know, I'd be having a look at, you know, bringing everyone in for a day or even taking half a day off if you have to split up in two groups, do it that way. But, you know, go through the process of, you know, giving them all a first aid qualification. It can't hurt the business. You may improve morale. You know, I'm a big fan of open book management and improving employee engagement. And the thing that the way that you do that is that you come from a position of valuing the valuing the input that the employees make, as well as giving them the agency to look after things themselves and to be able to respond to things. So if everyone's first aid qualified, then there's no reason why that they should turn around and say, oh, but you know what, no, I'm not first aid qualified. We'll just let Mary do it, or we'll let Barry do it, or we'll let Bill do it. But it's the thing, you know, they've all got the ability to do it themselves. They all take responsibility for things themselves. We know, we've had it drummed into us that safety in the workplace is everyone's responsibility. You're not just only responsible for your own safety. You're responsible for the safety of your colleagues, visitors, customers, volunteers, and all that sort of stuff. So that, you know, why shouldn't we do it that everyone has a first aid certificate? If it comes down to it that your award says that, hey, you know what, all the employer, whoever's a designated first aid attendant gets, you know, 2% of the standard rate. Yeah, have a look at that. That normally works out to be, you know, maybe $15, $20 a week extra. You know, if your business can afford it, then do it. You know, go through the process. You know, give them that little bit of extra money. You know, and that's the thing. This is all about valuing the contribution that they make. And two, the other side of the coin as well, is that, you know, you've got a first aid certificate, you've given them the training that they need for the first aid certificate and all that sort of stuff. You are in a low-risk workplace because, and you don't think that they'll ever need to use it there. But the thing is, though, with that, they can use it at home. They can use it on their way home from work. They can use it on their way to work in the morning. You know, how good would the PR be is that, you know, in the unfortunate incident where something happens to someone and, you know, they're on their way to work, that they're a bystander and they say, oh, you know, someone's had a, you know, collapse or something like that. You know, the recognition that they'd get by saying, oh, you know, hey, employee of so-and-so pulled over on the side of the road and rendered first aid, or they saw first someone collapse at the railway station and, you know, did that. So, but, you know, this is the thing. It's about doing what you can to help your employees and help society in general and all that sort of stuff. Now, you know, I'm as I said, being mindful of the time, I'm not going to get too much of a soapbox matter about that one. I might leave that one for another episode. But, you know, this is the thing. There are so many things that we can be doing to, rather than looking at, oh, what's the minimum we need, but look at the question of how can we provide it? How can we give this to everyone? How can we do it for everyone? How can we give everyone these skills and abilities to do this? So, but, you know, obviously it's a different train of thought. Not everyone's going to be on board with that one. Not everyone's going to agree with that one. But, hey, you know what? If you disagree with it, that's entirely up to you. It's the thing is that we need to change our practices. We need to change what we're doing in this, the 21st century. We need to do things differently. We need to look at everything that we do with regards to employment relationships, employment and all that sort of stuff. We need to look at all that, doing that differently. So anyway, as I said, open book management, big fan of that. Give them the skills that they need to be able to handle, manage everything that happens in the workplace. Train them all up. What's the least going to happen? Improves morale. Improves morale and productivity by, what, 1%? That's bound to be worth more than the $20 a week payment that they get and everything like that. So anyway, happy to hear your thoughts. Let me know what they are. You'll be able to find the show notes for this one on irsimplified.com.au/episode77. That is the two number sevens, episode 77. So anyway, thank you for listening. My name's Cameron Blewett. This was the IR Simplified podcast, and I look forward to having you join us for another one next week. Okay, bye for now.